Welcome to Mysterious Goings On. It's me, Alex Greenwood, and we are at that time of year again, that spooky season that if you're a longtime listener to the show, you know it's my favorite. It's my Christmas. It's Halloween time, and I cannot think of a better lead-in as we go from all the way up till next week. We're going to do a special show, which I'll tell you about at the end of this one, but this week's show I'm terribly excited about because we have somebody who is not just what I would call just, but not a horror writer per se, but he is a crafter of stories that has all of the right elements as far as I'm concerned. And this gentleman writes everything from horror to supernatural to science fiction even, and then to just plain weird. And so I'm very excited to welcome here to the show, Tom Carnell. His fiction has been featured in Swank Magazine, Carpe Noctem Magazine, and in the horror anthology, Bloody Carnival from Pill Hill Press. He's best known for his insightful interviews and profiles in Carpe Noctem, Fangoria Magazine, another favorite, and on Dread Central and TwitchFilm.com. He's a member of the Bonus Material Podcast, available via Stitcher, iTunes, and YouTube. Carnell is also a graduate of the San Francisco College of Mortuary Science, a certified eye and nucleist, we'll get into that for a bit, and a registered polysomnographic technologist. His novels, No Flesh Shall Be Spared, Moonlight Serenades, and A String of Pearls are available through Amazon.com and Crossroad Press. He currently lives in Bellingham, Washington, and he's got a brand new book of short stories we're going to talk about too. Tom Carnell, welcome to Mysterious Goings On.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, are you into Halloween at all? Or is this one of those things where it's like, God, I live with this crap all year? No.
Well, for us, Halloween is mostly for procurement of home decor. So, you know, it's like people go down, like we were just at Spirit and we're looking around and it's different to go, oh, this is cool and this will be good for tonight. This is us looking at things going like, this will look great on our mantelpiece forever.
Oh my God. There are others like me out there. That's so fantastic. Our entire house is decorated and it's kind of a bummer with COVID. We're not exactly entertaining anyone. But I don't care. I've got our little Halloween village set up. I've got all these mantelpieces, these weird candles. My daughter, she's 12. She's totally into it. She's finally at the age where it doesn't scare her. It just intrigues her. So it's really good to meet a fellow traveler in that regard.
Yeah, we absolutely love it. I mean, we live in a small town now, so we don't get a lot of traffic up and down, you know, through the doors and stuff. But yeah, I've got a new granddaughter we're sort of just showing this stuff to her. And, you know, it's pretty special.
Oh, congratulations on that. I've always enjoyed that aspect of being a parent is to kind of show off my certain, I guess, idiosyncratic hobbies to my daughter. And it's nice to see her picking up on them. So it's always a treat. But Tom, you go way back on the writing. You have, to write for Fangoria and Carpe Noctem. Tell me, though, you've written well over, what is it, 9 books now yourself?
I think it's up like that. There's a few interview books that we put out of the Carpe Noctem stuff just because we had some great access. I mean, at one point, I was scheduled for an hour, for example, with Neil Gaiman, and he said he began by saying, let me tell you about writing, and proceeded to talk for 3 hours. So it's like, I can't just have that appear one place that's going to be important for a minute and then go away. It's like, I got to put this into posterity and at least put it between some covers, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, that's such a game and story right there, isn't it?
I mean, know.
Did you find him to be truly a sweetheart like he seems to be?
Well, he's one of those people I lump in with like Clive Barker who you will meet him someplace and then you will meet him again 3 years later, and as you approach his table, they'll both look at you and go, Tom, right? And like immediately know who you are. And I've been really lucky in that most of my, I'm doing air quotes now, training and writing was done. I mean, once I got past elementary English and that kind of stuff, you know, grammar, punctuation, but sitting at the knees of people, you know, interviewing them for Fango or for Carpe Noctem or whoever, and being able to like ask all the questions and not have it be an instructor at a local college that was right. giving you his opinion. It's like, no, this is what you do want to do. This is what you don't want to do, kind of a thing. And it was really helpful. That in the fact that I watch a lot of film and I read a lot of books. So, you know, I've been doing 3 and 4 movies a day since I was like 5. So, you know, and this time of year, especially, I'm kind of dragging my wife. We just watched a bunch of Universal and Hammer stuff, which she had never seen.
Oh, wow.
I mean, at one point my wife goes, I've never seen Bride of Frankenstein. And I was like, wow, when I married you?
Yeah, really?
But we watched it and she absolutely loved it.
You know, that movie is what, 70 something years old now or more. And mm-hmm. it is still chilling and still so incredibly well done. And James yeah. Whale, totally, totally underrated. Sad story. I remember the Ian McKellen movie about him, Gods and Monsters, mm-hmm. Which I really enjoyed. But yeah, oh man, Tom, I'm totally with you on Bride of Frankenstein. I think I actually sang with my wife. I don't think she'd really seen it. She thought she had, but she watched it and she made this comment. It was so funny. She says, it was so great. She goes, you know, that's kind of better than I thought it was going to be, or I thought it was. You know what I mean? She had it in her mm-hmm. head that it was something. And then she watched it now as an adult and realized, my God, that's some incredible filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are times when I use that cred when we sit down to watch, like we just watched the Hammer Evil of Frankenstein, which was terrible. Mm-hmm. But yeah. She was like, just kept looking at me. I go, but I gave you Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, okay. See, we're already getting off my track here because I got to ask you now. You opened the door with this. So are there any Hammer films that are not, in your opinion, terrible? And I'm not trying to say they all are, but I got to tell you, that is one area though, when I watched them all as a kid, I was like, oh my God, I'm watching them a lot more now. And I'm having a hard time picking the wheat from the chaff.
Mm. Yeah. I think, I mean, there's some, there's the Brides of Frankenstein with the blonde Dracula, which is kind of groovy, and a Horror of Dracula with that great ending with the ripping down of the curtains and,
yeah,
you know, yeah, there are moments. I used to talk about how, can we swear on this?
Of course you can.
Okay, good. That being a genre fan, it's kind of like panning for gold in a river of shit, where you have to just pan through all of this stuff and maybe you find this nugget that you can hold on to that later will always make you go, oh yeah, yeah, that's a great film or whatever, even though it's not. Or at the very least, you think, I'm going to steal that one day. I don't know how I'm going to change it, but I'm definitely stealing that moment.
Oh man.
You know, or at least it's the way it made me feel.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's so true. I just watched Demons 2, I think. I think it's a Fulci picture. I remember I saw that at the drive-in. I'm maybe just a little younger than you because I saw it at the drive-in in high school, like 1985, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I still kind of remembered this back of my mind. Oh, there was this movie and all these kids, Italian, but all these kids were like at a thing at a theater, and then everybody turns into demons and climbs out of somebody's back and all, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I went and watched it again the other night, and it just took me back. But there were certain moments, and I thought, my gosh, you know, this movie is so awful in so many ways, but so brilliant in so many others. So I'm with you on that. In the river of shit, I'm glad I got a paddle. Oh gosh, so many places to go with that. But now I got one little tendril. I just have to ask: have you seen the Oliver Reed Wolfman picture?
Oh yeah, we just watched that a couple of nights ago.
Oh, what are your thoughts on that one?
Takes him forever to change. You never see him as until that. Like Oliver had to have said, "I'm doing this makeup once, and you got to shoot everything on that day." But it's great. There's a real like lurid sort of sexiness to it, you know, which you don't expect. It's hard for me. I rant about this a lot, but like werewolves in general, kind of, I don't get it. Like I haven't been an anatomist and all this other stuff where you go, there's no way this happens in. You change from a man to a wolf and back in the span of about 8 or 10 hours. it just doesn't work that way. But then, you know, you kind of lean into the whole, it's magic. And then you hear Maria Ospenskaya in your ear talking. And then you're like, all right, I'm in.
Yeah. I was just about to quote that, but I won't because I'll mangle it. But that's what I was going to say. But can't you just hear the old lady? She's telling you, you have to be pure with all this stuff.
Well, you know, back Gloria Swanson and Sunset Boulevard talked about back then we had faces, and it's like, yeah, Maria Ospenskaya is one of them. The old lady in the Bogart Bacall Key Largo. There's a moment on the wharf where this old woman just looks at you, and it's like, You get her whole story just by the lines in her face, you know, just beautiful stuff. And for me, that's the real crux of it, right? Within all of this horrible goings on, there are moments of just sheer beauty that you just, again, I'm going to keep that, even if it's just for me, I'm going to keep that moment in my head and it'll make me a better person at the very least.
Well, so we're kind of dancing around the Halloween topic a little bit with great movies. And are there any books though that you may revisit? Like, for example, I revisit certain movies every year for Halloween. Of course, I watch Carpenter's Halloween, but I also watch Carpenter's The Thing, which is one of my all-time favorites. But then I also dip into universal classic horror of some sort. I don't know which one, just depends on the mood. But is there, perhaps that's a two-part question, are there books or movies that you dip into around this time of year without fail?
It depends on who I'm, like with my wife, there are things I think like she should see, like you should definitely see, All the Colors of the Dark, you know, this old giallo that from years and years ago, but, so I'll watch that stuff with her or so my kids or what have you. But if I'm alone, I'm not a big repeat watcher because every time I look at something, I go, oh, I should watch Halloween. But then I think, yeah, but there's 1,000 Edgar Wallace crimmy films that I haven't seen. And I need to see that. Cause I don't want to know what's happening. I like that feeling of, oh my God, what did he just do or whatever? And discovering it again. Certain things I'll go back to because I want to learn. I want to know the magic trick. I want to see where he moved the ball from under the cup, kind of a thing. And because I didn't see it the first time, right. So there's that. So, but there are definitely favorites. I'm a big, like I say, I'm a big giallo fan. I wish there was. I've been racking my brains for years trying to figure out how to do a giallo in prose. You know, to do a book that's a giallo without it just seeming sort of trite, because so much of that stuff is the music and the vibe and the clothes and the beautiful women and just all the way it all comes together. I'd love to try to do that. But more and more I've become convinced that it would just wouldn't work in the same way. So maybe one day. But as for books, I'm the same way. I'll read something and I move on. Lately, I've been doing a lot of, because of the No Flesh Shall Be Spared stuff, it's a lot of what I call tough guy fiction. You know, a lot of Don Hamilton, a lot of, you know, guys waving guns in dames' faces and that kind of thing. So in general, I'm not a guy that revisits a lot, unless, like I say, unless I'm there because someone else is there. It's like, come with me. I know the way through the woods. You know? So yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the writing itself. When did you lead into actually writing your own fiction that got published? When did that start to happen for you in relationship to you writing for Fango and other stuff like that?
So let's see. Back when I got married in the mid 80s, my wife and I were getting our kids together and all of this kind of thing. We started to attend Fango cons. And through that, I started to meet people that were really important. Or I didn't know at the time they were, but they were. Chaz Ballin comes up, who was a guy who I would see every year at Fango cons, and it was this weird compulsion of mine to check in with Chaz and say, here's all the stuff you talked to me about last year, and I saw it all. Give me more. And he'd scribble all these things down, and it became really great. Then in the 90s, when we started doing Carpe Noctem, that became a thing where everyone was became available, right? We at that point, we had the sales and that kind of thing that we could get past the PR people and all of that other stuff. And so now we're starting to sit down with all crazy people, Barker and Gaiman and Frank Miller and just, whatever. Since we were sort of running it, there was never anyone that would come up that I would table that could get shot down. I mean, we did a long philosophical piece with a guy named Gino Vannelli, who no one knows about. He's a singer from the 80s. He did a song called "I Just Want to Stop."
Wait, did he do "Living Inside Myself"?
Yeah, that's him.
I know Gino Vannelli, yeah.
So I'm a big fan. And so my wife comes to me, she goes, "You want to talk to Gino Vannelli on your birthday?" I'm like, "Fuck yeah." So what? We sat down and we talked about philosophy and theophacy and all of this kind of stuff, and it was great. So it was a way to bring these whoever in it, because my message was always, we all have this in whoever, no matter what you think a person does. I learned Tina Turner is a huge horror fiction fan, and I love that, because one of my philosophies in interviewing is find the thing your interview subject geeks on, and you won't have to even they'll tee up your next question. So
yeah.
Around that time, working for Fango, working for Dread and all this other stuff, I just wanted to do fiction. And someone always said, write what you know. And because I had been to mortuary school and my other background, I really knew two things, zombies and fighting, because I've trained martial arts for years. And that comes together in No Flesh Shall Be Spared, which is essentially the UFC with zombies, right? It's a big league of people. I the pitch on that has always been Gladiator meets Dawn of the Dead. Ooh. So it's that kind of a thing. And it was able to, do the creepiness of the dead folk, but also get in there and punch zombie grandmas in the face. And it was just great. And so after that, I kind of, around that time the book came out, my mom passed, and I sort of fell into this whole writer's block thing for like 2 years. And then Moonlight Serenades is a result of me, that's me finding my way back. Everything that's in the short story collections, it's not, let me pick the best of what I have. It's literally, here's the next thing I'm working on. Here's the next thing I'm working on. Oh. So it was all sort of coming together. And at that point, I allowed myself the freedom to, it was a conscious decision not to have the focus be this book or this tale, but the focus be, here's a fountain from which all of this comes from. So that way I could get away with anything. As you said in the very kind intro about being able to go from science fiction to horror to, there's some stuff in the new books, both Tuxedo Junction, and I just turned in something called Horror Book. That's pretty radical. I mean, there's a piece in there that talks about taking a person, like rendering a body into usable cuts of meat.
So
there's this kind of thing. So the idea is whatever, it usually starts with an idea hitting me and me laughing at it because I think it's ridiculous. There's a story in Moonlight Serenades where it's an entire world where social hierarchy is based on what kind of clown you are. So Harlequins are the 1%. And then there's the very bottom is the what we're going to call the low down dirty mimes. And that just made me laugh. The idea of a tough guy pointing a gun at someone and say, "Listen, clown," that was it. I was off and running. I know. So so once that idea clicks, the thing I'm working right now is called Howling at the Haitian Moon. And it's in that basket with things like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and Martin and Lewis's Scared Stiff. And it's just a big monster mash where everyone you meet is something. And that's just, I'm just maybe 2,000 words into that now, but it's so fun because it's like all of the stuff we just talked about, reaching into all that universal stuff and going, oh yeah, there's that moment where's this? And we need to have our Maria Ospenskaya. We need to have our mad doctor on the hill. And so it usually starts with me laughing about something, just being ridiculous, or some challenge. There was a story where I wanted to change the entire thing on the last line. And it worked. It was a piece, I'm spacing on the name, but it has to do with an old woman in a walking in a mountain, and she finds a lost child. And everything was set up, and I wanted it to spin on the dime at the very last sentence. And it worked. God, I can't even remember that name. That's kind of weird. So it was a desire, I think, to... I've always been a story junkie. Mm-hmm. I grew up sitting on my grandfather's knee as he would, you know, tell me, look, let me tell you, son, one time we were da da da. You would be like, yeah, just lapping it up. And I tend to tell stories in my daily life. So it was kind of, this was mostly me just trying to focusing that onto the page. And luckily people have, you know, kind of responded to that.
Longtime listeners to the show know that my grandfather wrote Westerns and for 50 years, and he was successful mid-lister, if you can call yourself that. And he'd tell me stories, and we would make up stories together. And it's informed how I am. Again, yet another fellow traveler moment here, because I tend to speak in storytelling to people. I try to illustrate my thoughts with a story or story-ish elements, which most people are fine with. Some people find it tedious, I think, but that's okay.
Yeah, my wife does a lot of that pinching motion, like, all right, bring it in.
Yeah, mine too. She's kinda like,
but you know, the same thing used to happen with the kids. We would, when they were little, we would go to the mall, and while mom was doing her shopping and whatever, we would sit there, and the mandate was, look at that guy, and we'd make up a story about him. You know, the woman that's pushing an empty baby cart because her husband has the baby, but all we saw was her with the empty cart. Let's go with that. Now the kids are in on it, and they're telling me, what if she did this and what if she did that? And I'm like, yeah. So it's always been about that. You know, I think that story is how we define ourselves, and in that we can level what's important to us, that we can talk about the things that are maybe, you know, concerning. I've done some pieces on marriage that my therapist is like, I'd like to see those, please. So, you know, I think it's just, for me, it's just the way I deal with the world. It's all of this stuff sort of pours into my head, and, you know, what filters out gets used.
And are you primarily into short stories, would you say?
I like the short story because I think it's like a watch. Like you can't have a lot of gristle. You can't have a lot of nonsense. You know, it's like, as a friend of mine used to say of dating, get in, do a lot of damage, and then get the hell out. And so short stories can allow me that. Some things have blossomed. I wrote a thing called The Sword of St. Michael about the pitch on that in my head was Jean-Claude Van Damme Exorcist. So that begat this Father Thorpe that is sort of the John Wick of priests. and that's blossomed into three or four different stories. I just wrote a story called The Dagger of Golgotha that has to do with a knife made from the nails that hung Jesus on the cross.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. So that and marijuana probably helps more than anything. As I used to say, you don't get to Clown Town without, you know, a little of that, a little whiskey, a little of that. Yeah.
No, I understand. Well, if I could, I'm going to bring it for a moment to Tuxedo Junction, which I read ahead. And I'm seeing a few things here. And first of all, you mentioned Clive Barker. And I had heard an interview, forgive me, I don't remember who it was recently. It was someone who was talking about Clive Barker's films. And most people, of course, identify him strictly with The Hellraiser and the Books of Blood. But actually, this person said, you know, Clive doesn't just write horror. In fact, he writes very little horror these days. Maybe that's incorrect. I don't know. I don't read all of Clive's latest. But that's kind of when I started to see you here, when I started reading Tuxedo, because you, and by the way, you have a device here that I love that Harlan Ellison does or did, rest his soul, where you do a little intro kind of saying, this is where I was when I wrote this. You even are kind of critical of yourself slightly at some points on this, where you just say, well, look, I was doing this then. I don't know if this is any good. Or, you know, you don't say it exactly like that, but I get that feeling.
So that's totally, that's the sentiment. Yeah, I don't know if this is any good.
But I get that, you know, and I see that. So you really are, I don't even know if you care if you are or you're not, but you seem to be a little bit difficult to pigeonhole for a certain genre, because you do jump around and you do other genres very effectively.
Yeah, it's the nail I hang the hat on, right? I feel like story is story and everything else is just the drag of it, right? It's the, it's the costumes or we're still addressing some things that are fundamental. And then it just becomes like, there's one about, that's a sci-fi thing in a new book that, I have a friend, my friend Joe Weber is a huge sci-fi fan. And we always argue about this. But he's always tried to do some sci-fi. And so I go, okay, I will. And then I wanted to do more than just, you know, pulse rifles and rocket ships sort of a thing. And so I took it to a sort of a more personal place. There's a lot of that. I mean, there are pieces in the books and in the books that are coming that are really personal about my relationship with my mom and with my dad and with growing up, as a reader in a family of non-readers, that kind of a thing. So it's mostly for me it's me kind of therapy, working stuff out, but also posing to myself what I call a puzzler. It's like, can you do this? Can you pull this off? And then there's the Venn diagram of, you know, huge ego meeting low self-esteem. And you're like, well, I don't know if this is any good, but I leave it to others to sort of interpret. I don't think you can interpret your own work. I think it's left. Mm-hmm. It's just something you do, and you leave others to decide.
Yeah. And one of my best readers, she said this recently. She said that authors who are so self-critical do their readers a disservice, because there are readers who adore their work. And then when they see an author poo-poo their own work, it makes the reader feel like they have bad taste. And I thought, wow, because I've done that. Yeah. I've interviewed so many wonderful authors who are head and shoulders more successful than I'll ever be. Oops, there I go again. But are at the moment more successful. And I just think, my stuff's crap, you know. But then my friends who do read this, or readers who don't even know me, read this. And then I just never realized the bind I was putting them in. But I got to ask you something here on Tuxedo Junction. I'm getting, and here, you can't really contradict me, because this is what I pulled out of it. But I'm going to say it anyway. I see a thread here of loss.
Yeah,
I see a thread here of, I'll tell you what pulled at me. There's so many, besides loss, there's also seems to be lost connection with children, or children who don't have their parents. And I found it very moving, some of these stories where we went that direction.
Well, thank you. I worked in funeral service for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of grief counseling and I just, you know, we talk about beautiful moments, those moments that you'll, like, some things that happened to me while being a funeral arranger and a funeral director that I never will want to forget, because they were so important and they were so profound in that moment and beyond, that I just think that's rich ground. Because everyone has experienced some kind of loss, whether it's the loss of a parent, you know, God forbid, the loss of a child, the loss of a dog, you know. And so I think it's fertile ground for me to plant my little seeds or what have you.
So Tom, I'll confess too that I've known some other folks who've worked in that line of work, and. And here's the difference that I'm not hearing from you. And I'm sure that there must be a degree of distance you have to put between yourself and dealing with grief on a daily basis, and maybe even black humor and that kind of thing. But you seem to have embraced it to a degree, and as you said, you're kind of saving some of these pieces of it that are beneficial, and you're using these things. But did you ever get to a point, and I assume you're not doing this anymore? You said you did it for about a decade, but where you just couldn't do it anymore? I interviewed, for example, Douglas Skelton. He's a best-selling Scottish mystery thriller writer, and he was like me, a former newspaper reporter, and he had the crime beat, and he just said, basically, I'm paraphrasing, got to a point where it was really difficult to be on the beat and see such brutality continuing. So I put the same question to you. Did you ever get to a point where it's like, I can't look at another dead body, I can't deal with another grieving family, or was it something else?
Well, I cry a lot. And cried a lot. So every day I would come home, like I would work, and in the middle of the day I would go for my walk during my lunch hour, and it was usually me going someplace and just weeping, and then coming back. Then at the end of the day I would come home, and it was a given. I would come home, come into my office for a half hour or so, put some music on, and just cry. One day my wife came to me and said, I think we need to talk. I'm like, oh, okay. And she said, I'm noticing you're not doing that anymore. You're not going into your office and you're not crying. You're not offloading all of that emotion. Cause I like to think I'm a bit of an empath and I carry a lot of that stuff with me. So at that point, I was at a place, Greenwood in San Diego, and that it was hugely. We were doing. I would have 9/11, 1, 3, and 5 o'clock appointments with families. So you would go from one intense situation of grief and loss, and then have a cup of coffee, and then go right into the next one. So for me, it got to a point where I knew that I had seen others in that field become callous. And to wall themselves off and subsequently develop a pretty big drinking problem. Yeah. And I just didn't want that for myself. And it always reminds me of something, I think Ken Kesey was it that said that about drugs. He said, drugs have a message, but it's important to know when to hang up the phone. And I just felt like I need to hang up the phone on this. Otherwise, I'm going to lose something that I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose this empathy. I don't want to know what it's like. Any of this is like, so then I left. It had to mostly had to do with the libertine aspect of it. Companies that don't care about people, telling you about flower minimums and, we like to include what's the line they used to say about it? It's customary to include a single flower in the casket from the family. No, it's not. It's you trying to up your flower sales. So at that point I'm like, okay, I'm done. This is no longer serving me. And that's when I went into sleep, and I worked in sleep for a really long time.
Well, there's a story in Tuxedo Junction, Making Plans.
That really happened.
Okay. Well, you did your Harlan Ellison beginning, and I thought, and you're like, I've changed the name, but you never really know, right? You never know. It's like Fargo. They say we change the names, and of course that crap never happened at Fargo. But here's the thing: once I got to the ending of that story, I realized it really did happen to you, or at least you observed it or were close enough to it, and so that really did, right?
Yeah. And the funny thing is I know a lot of funeral directors who, if you mention that scenario to, they'll just go, oh yeah, that's happened to us too. So when I was at a place in San Jose, California, someone, in fact, when they, instead of going to the car, they just went to the bathroom in the building. Really? They just went to the bathroom and shot themselves. Yeah. But that for me becomes this whole landscape of, let's put ourselves in that guy's position.
Sure.
And let's put ourselves in the other guy's, in the funeral director's. How would I react if my doctor, for example, I did a piece called I Am Legend, another one of the books, immediately after a doctor telling someone you're terminal, and how do you piece that together? You try to do your best. You try to run it through that filter that is your experience. And hopefully others will get something out of it as well.
Well, and you did, we spoke offline about, and we don't have to go on because I was telling you that I have an irrational thing with eyes, but you were in a nucleus, right? And you learned to remove eyes for transplantation, correct?
Yeah, cornea transplants, that kind of a thing. It was a really odd, Savini talked about thinking he was an assassin because he would pack up his gear, go to another town, kill somebody, and then leave. And it felt like that. In the middle of the night, the phone would ring. I'd have to get into my suit, get into my car, go to the hospital, do my thing, and then, you know, give the eyes to the nurse, who would then give it to the Lion's Eye Bank and that kind of thing. So it was dark, but, you know, it also, again, within all of that, there are these moments that are just so beautiful and so profound that it's just an honor to be in the room, you know.
Well, the idea that you are facilitating perhaps curing someone's blindness, the great sacrifice obviously that folks made. I'm an organ donor, and I assume if I go in decent condition that might happen to me, who knows. I hope they do. I had to bring that dimension in there because it's just a little too rich of a detail to leave out, you know. And what you see, Tom, it's in our closing minutes there, I really want to just catch a couple of other things real quick, if you don't mind, a little bit of a bonus round, lightning round kind of deal here, but you've also been doing podcasting for a long time.
Yeah, it was a thing where I started back in around the time that the first book came out, doing a thing called The Night Crew with another writer named Sean Smithson. And that got me like, oh, this is just like interviewing for the magazine, but there's no transcription, which is awesome, because nice. Who likes transcription? And then that stopped, and then I started to do one on my own, and that just got lonely, you know, just you wanted someone to do it with. I'm sure you can relate to that kind of thing.
I know the feeling.
And then we did a local guy here. He's an effects artist named Langley J. West, who was also one of my martial arts instructors. He was a big film guy. And so we started doing that. And between all of that, again, it's more of that sitting at the knee of really gifted people. And if not getting direct advice, at least hearing in your ear the headspace that they're coming from. You know, about like, this is how you're a professional. This is how you don't waste a lot of people's time. This is how you conduct yourself. Yeah.
Well, did you find though, once you do find a good partner on a podcast though, like you said, sitting at the knee, the one reason I love doing this is because I get to meet people like yourself and I always learn something. One thing I've learned though, over doing this for years, is to do my best not to be a tedious interviewer and ask questions people get all the time. So forgive me if I gave you too many of those today.
No, not at all. It's great.
I just find it fascinating what you've done and what you're doing. So Tuxedo Junction is Macabre Inc. imprint of Crossroad Press out this year. Mm-hmm. You can get it all the usual suspects, I assume, Amazon, etc.
Yeah, it comes out December 15th. Okay. But it's available for pre-order. But the other two collections, the first zombie book and then the follow-up Don't Look Back, is out there. And that's just super muscly. It's, you know, it's guys punching each other and shooting 7-year-olds in the face. And
yeah, your usual. That's great. No, I'm into that. I love that. I write mystery thrillers. And you know, one thing I was going to mention to you with the short story aspect, one thing for a lark, I'm on book 8 of this series, which is probably about book 5 books too many for most readers. But anyway, the one time I felt I was really getting just sleepy is when I decided, what the hell? I'm going to take all the supporting characters of this series, not the main hero. He's never going to be in it. And I'm going to write short stories around several of them. And I created 7 short stories. And I did what you did to a degree. One of them is even kind of science fiction-y because it takes place in the future. And then there's some that take place in the past. And I had a blast. And guess what? It's like most fans who even write to me say, that book is right up there as my favorite or my top 2. And, the reason I mention that is because when I talk to you and I see how successful you are with short stories, I'm beginning to think, Tom, that maybe the process for me is getting to where short stories are about where I should be. I'm actually finding it difficult to crank out a full scale novel again. So I'm kind of putting it in a different way, but I think the only way I'm going to save my ability to continue to write anything for at least in the near future is to focus on short stories. Any thoughts on that?
I think there are short stories are a great idea to sort out of like, will it fly? Like, does this even work? And rather than committing to 80,000 words, I can commit to 5. And that's a couple of days, right, of writing and revising and editing. And the hard part that I'm finding now is having done so many short stories, now that I'm buckling down for another novel, it's hard. It's like, oh, no, slow down. You don't have to rush. You don't have to like rush to, it's the line from Meaning of Life. How about a kiss, boy? How about starting with a kiss? So it's that.
John Cleese, yes.
Yeah. And then the thing I keep putting off is I have to bring this zombie sort of franchise thing in for a landing. Hmm. I have to, at the third book, I've kind of got mapped out. I know what I want to do. And I've set it up to a point where I think I can pull it off. But a lot of that zombie stuff is super easy. It's mostly just making sure I include everything because I got it. I don't need to do research on what a prep room looks like. I don't need to do research on what dead people look like. So yeah, I think that it's, again, it's all about connection and being fertile ground and trying to put out the stuff that I want to read, because a lot of what I'm reading now, what did Truman Capote say? That's not writing, that's typing.
Yeah, or what Harrison Ford said to George Lucas, George, you can type this shit, but you sure can't say.
I've never heard that. I'd love that.
Oh, man, Tom, thank you for that. And I appreciate that. And, it's funny that so much of that sounds is the zombie end sounds easy to you because you've got all that background too, but I'm sure some modicum of talent has to go into that as well. And I'm looking forward to reading up on all of your work, and I'm thrilled to meet you. And if folks want to meet you, outside the show, where would they go? What websites are the best places to find you?
Well, I have my tomcarnell.com that has everything. It's got all the podcast episodes. It's got interviews. There's an interview with Karen Black that never saw air up there and that kind of a thing. There's that. There's my Amazon page. I post incessantly to Facebook. Right now, I'm doing a lot of I took 2 years off of watching movies, and now I'm back. So now I'm just throwing up, like last night we watched, the Spider-Verse, followed by a documentary on Giallo, followed by Mario Bava's Danger Diabolic. And my wife is along for the ride. And so Facebook is good. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram.
Well, I will put all those links in our show notes. Tom Carnell, oh my goodness, fantastic writer, journalist, funeral director, embalmer, grief counselor. It just goes on and on. And it's been fascinating speaking with you. Thanks so much for appearing with us here on Mysterious Goings On.
Thank you, sir.
And we will be featuring a very fun episode next week. I hope Tom's got your appetite all whetted for this. It's going to be pretty fun. I can tell you, we've got a lot of people who've submitted their 5 minutes or less weird happenings, ghost stories, Halloween stories, jokes, whatever. It's all coming your way on our next episode. So in the meantime, I recommend you look into Tom's stuff. Links are in the show notes. And until that next spooky moment, keep reading.
Get a credit card that gives you what you need now. A low interest rate on everyday purchases and a place to transfer high interest rate balances. The PenFed Gold Contactless Card is our lowest interest rate credit card. You can even earn a $100 statement credit when you spend $1,500 in the first 90 days. Join PenFed, and together we can help you keep more of what's yours. Visit PenFed.org/goldcard. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA. A little flexibility can go a long way. By refinancing your newer used auto loan with PenFed, you can lower your monthly payments for more flexibility in your budget. You can even schedule your first payment for up to 60 days from the date of your refinance. Calculate how much you could save at PenFed.org/auto-refi or call 1-800-247-5626 to apply. Membership is open to everyone. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.